Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Branches of Wisdom, the Banyan Books podcast and event series. I'm your host, Ross McKeachy. Very excited today that we have Dr. Daniel Goleman as our guest. Before we get to his formal introduction, I want to let you know that although we have people joining us from all over the world for these live streaming events, the physical location of Banyan Books and Sound is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Most of Banyan's podcasts and event series are free. We welcome your donations to keep these programs accessible for all. Just click on the PayPal link in the show description below. Also, letting you know, towards the end of our conversation today, we'll be taking questions from you, the live audience. So go ahead and type those into the comments field on YouTube, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. Okay, our guest. Daniel Goleman is an internationally esteemed psychologist and author who has transformed the way the world educates children, relates to family and friends, leads and conducts business. A frequent speaker on campuses and to businesses of all kinds and sizes, he has worked with organizations around the globe examining the way social and emotional competencies impact the bottom line. His book, Emotional Intelligence, was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year and a half, and has been a bestseller in many countries with over 5 million copies in print. Emotional Intelligence was named one of the 25 most influential business management books by Time magazine. Apart from his writing on emotional intelligence, Goleman has written books on topics including self-deception, creativity, transparency, meditation, social and emotional learning, eco-literacy, and the ecological crisis. Today, Daniel Goleman is with Banyan Books in conversation about his new book, Optimal: How to Sustain Personal and Organizational Excellence Every Day. In Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman revolutionized how we think about intelligence. Now, in Optimal, he reveals practical methods for using these inner resources to more readily enter an optimal state of high performance and satisfaction while avoiding burnout. If you'd like to learn more about today's distinguished guest, you can visit his website, danielgoleman.info. And there you can also learn more about his online emotional intelligence program, which offers anyone a deep understanding of the competencies of self-awareness, self-management, empathy, and social skill. So, Banyan community, a warm welcome for Daniel Goleman.
Hi, Ross. Thanks. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Okay. I'm curious a little bit about your journey to where you are today. Okay. On your website, I read about your education. You had a scholarship from the Ford Foundation to attend Harvard, where you enrolled in the program in clinical psychology. And then you ended up on your pre-doctoral fellowship traveling to India, where you're able to study ancient systems of psychology and the accompanying meditation practices of Asian religions. I'm just curious what you learned on that journey to India and how that led you into the work you've been doing to this day.
Well, I don't know if I can draw a straight line from my 2 years in India to emotional intelligence. I think there's a little bit of a zig and a zag there. However, I will say this. I first went to India because of Ram Dass. Do you remember Ram Dass?
Yes.
He passed away, but he was a very influential figure for a long time in the spiritual world. And I ran into him just after he'd come back from India the first time he was there. He just became Ram Dass. He had been Richard Alpert, and it turned out that he had been working in the very same department I was currently enrolled in at Harvard when I met him. So we had a lot to talk about. And I went to India actually to meet his teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, and spent time with him. And then through one of those zigs or zags, I ended up in Bodh Gaya, India, studying Vipassana meditation with some people who have become some of the early teachers of insight meditation, like Sharon Salzberg was there, Joseph Goldstein was there. Back at Harvard, when I came back, I had a student who you've had on your show. His name's Mark Epstein.
Oh, yes.
He wrote The Zen of Therapy. Mark and I wrote an article together on his dissertation topic, which was a rather abstruse model from Buddhism of mental health. I was the only person he could find who knew anything about it. And we've become fast friends. So anyway, that was a very seminal time. Then I went on, because I was very interested in what we would now call the psychology of consciousness, I was kind of a square peg in a round hole. I didn't fit in any department of psychology. I was too ahead of my time, so to speak. So I ended up as a science journalist. I ended up at the New York Times for 12 years. And while I was there, I read this obscure article in a journal that was not widely known or read called Emotional Intelligence. It was written by a guy who's now the president of Yale University, but he was very junior faculty back then. And I thought, wow, that is such a great phrase. What an oxymoron. You don't put emotions together with intelligence, or you didn't then. Then I realized it was being intelligent about emotions. And I use that as a frame for the book you described that became very popular in many places around the world. And I went on to refine that model. Thank you for mentioning the Daniel Goleman Emotional Intelligence Program online for people that want to know more and get a deeper understanding of what makes people outstanding performers in this domain. And very interesting, the relationship between IQ and emotional intelligence, because all of our school years, it's all about cognitive ability, IQ. But once you're in the workplace, you know what? It doesn't matter so much. It's more about how you handle yourself and how you handle relationships. Self-awareness and empathy are key. And that's the emotional intelligence. So I would say there is some relationship between my years in Asia and India, but it's not a straight line.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. This book was really interesting to me. And I think the first thing to touch on for people is to understand what you mean by optimal, the title of the book, and how that, you know, there's this state of optimal functioning versus the better known flow state.
Sure.
Differentiate. So maybe we can just.
So flow was discovered by researchers at the University of Chicago, and the optimal state by research done at Harvard Business School. And they fit together in a really interesting way. They're both on the same spectrum. They both, for example, I talked about meditation. From a cognitive science point of view, I see meditation as essentially attention training. Take the belief system apart, and what you're left with is reminding yourself to come back to the point of focus or to the perspective that you're supposed to assume in meditation. And one of the keys there is actually mindfulness, because when your mind wanders, and our minds always wander, and you notice it wandered, the direction is always bring it back to the point of either the variety of focus or the point of focus in the meditation. That is training the brain or the neural circuitry, strengthening the neural circuitry for focus for paying full attention. So it turns out that focus is a pathway into what we call the optimal state. So let me talk about flow versus optimal. Flow is that one time you were absolutely fantastic. You outdid it yourself. Can't believe how well I did. The problem with flow is you can't make it happen. It's like grace. It comes, you know, it's something that falls from the sky and you're at your absolute best ever. We think it's more reasonable to aim for optimal, which is beneath flow, but on the same spectrum. It's a state, Harvard research found, where you're at your best, you're highly productive, and whatever that means for what you're doing, it might be getting the kids to school, or it might be on your job. You are very engrossed, you're engaged in what you're doing, you're satisfied, you feel good, you're connected to the people around you. That's an optimal state. And by the way, it's highly prized by businesses, but also it's highly prized by anyone. You want to feel good doing whatever it is you do. And so we think this is a more reasonable target. And it's still, you know, it's maybe just below flow, or you could say, but it covers a wider variety when you're feeling pretty good and doing well. And we think that that's more realistic. And also, by the way, I do think that meditations of all kinds, which are, as I said, attention training, help you make that more frequent in your life.
Right. So we can actually train for the optimal state, which may at times out of our control lead into flow, but we can actually activate the optimal state more at will. Is that right?
I think so. And you don't activate it by saying, okay, I magically want to become more engaged and productive and happy right now. That's not going to help you. Actually, it's training the brain. And that's why I like meditation as a pathway in, because as you strengthen your ability to attend to what you choose to attend to, and every brand of meditation is essentially that, the more you do that, the stronger the circuitry for becoming absorbed and focused on whatever it is at hand becomes. And that means that you can be engaged in whatever you're doing because you know how to focus on it.
Right. Okay. In the area of focus, when we're focusing on work, for instance, what has your research or experience shown in terms of how much time we should aim to spend focused on a task? And how often should we be taking a break, giving ourselves a rest or recovery?
Well, let me talk a little bit about stress and burnout.
Sure.
When you feel you have to be doing this task, and it's often at work, but you're not really into it and you're being pressured to do it, that creates stress. And too many jobs today are full of stress. The body is designed to manage stress well, particularly in an emergency, but then the body is designed to have a recovery period. That's called the parasympathetic system. That's the recovery mode. And the sympathetic nervous system, that's when you're really anxious, upset, trying to do that thing. And so what I would say is that we need a period of rest built into our daily schedule. And rest might be whatever you enjoy. Maybe playing with kids, being with someone you love, could be meditation, yoga. Different people find different things restful, walk in nature, whatever it is. Do it daily, because that is an antidote to burnout. The path to burnout starts with the unremitting stress I talked about, which leads to emotional exhaustion, and then to burnout. And for example, in workplace, people often quit because of this, or want to, or feel I'm just going to do enough of my job to keep it until I can get another one.
Yeah. Can we talk about perfectionism and how that relates, Dan? I've got a quote here from the book, which I'd like to share and then lead into a question. So you write, holding ourselves to our highest standard, we suspect makes us prone to a perfectionism that can easily bring exhaustion and burnout. We just can't be at our peak in every moment all the time, but we can always strive to do our best. The relentless pursuit of flow points us toward extremes, while doing our best offers a more realistic goal.
Well, this is simple psychology. You know, I'm really talking about that monologue in our mind that's sometimes called self-talk, where we have a constant narrative about life, about what we're doing, about random stuff. And if you're a perfectionist, that self-talk often has critiques. People who are perfectionists tend to see what they did wrong and what other people do wrong. They don't see what they're doing right. And they focus on what was wrong and push themselves to get to do better and better, which may pay off. But, you know, if you're a perfectionist, your relationships suffer, your health can suffer. I think it's just not a healthy stance to have. That if you find that you're criticizing yourself or you focus on what you did wrong and you don't appreciate what you did right or what you're grateful for and how people have helped you along, if that never comes to mind, it's a kind of toxicity, if you will. And so I think it's much better to have a kind of positive outlook. In fact, we, in our model of emotional intelligence, one of the things in the second domain, there are four domains: self-awareness, self-management, empathy, social skill. In the self-management domain, it's not just handling your moments of being upset, it's also marshaling positive feelings, a positive outlook. That's really important in helping you be agile and helping you stay feeling good about what you're doing, stay motivated, and keep your eye on the big goal. So all of that is important.
What are some of the ways, like, for a perfectionist, they might make the argument, well, this behavior, this way of viewing things has actually allowed me a great deal of success in my life.
And then I would say, and how many divorces have you had?
Okay, simple as that, yeah.
Well, because it's too narrow a definition of life.
Right.
You know, okay, so you succeeded. This is interesting. One of the competencies that we talk about in emotional intelligence is keeping your eye on goals that matter to you. And if you're highly ambitious and a perfectionist, that goal is, I want that promotion, I want this position. And you drive yourself like 120% to get there. Perfectionists will work longer and harder and be rewarded within that narrow reward system. But life is bigger than that. What about your family? What about your friends? What about your relationships? What about your health? All of that is likely to suffer if you're overly perfectionistic. So it's not that you don't have goals. It's just that you have a life too.
Right. Now, you touched on something there, which is social connection. And I know that that is a big indicator of mental, emotional, and physical well-being. And you touch on that in your work. It seems like one of those things that maybe people miss how that can impact their health. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there's a lot of research on, for example, a state of loneliness, feeling you have no real connections, and research that correlates it with mortality, death rate, illness, suicide. It's not a great state. But the opposite state of feeling well connected to a group of people, is to family and friends, is highly associated with longevity, with good health. So that's what the data shows. And I don't know if you're familiar with the research of an anthropologist named Robin Dunbar in the UK, but Dunbar is one who came up with a number that we can handle about 150 relationships in our life. And within that, there are concentric circles. Your family's the innermost. Next is your maybe five best buddies or best friends. And then there's like your next 15 closest people and then everyone else. And it's nurturing those relationships that help strengthen that sense of closeness, that sense of being connected.
How have you seen any ways that social media is impacting our sense of social connection or lack of?
You know, our cell phones are our best friend and worst enemy at the same time. You know, whatever social media, TikTok or whatever it may be, that draws your attention actually takes us away from the moment and the present. And the sad thing is too many people seem to be paying attention to social media and not to real people in their lives. And I think there's a real loss there. There's research done at Harvard where they asked people, they gave them an app that rang them at random times a day. And they found that people on average were distracted from the moment about 50% of the time, much more so at work, by the way, or when they're commuting, when they're watching a video, understandably maybe. But think about it, you know, are you choosing real life or pseudo life?
Right. Have you found any helpful ways for people to try and remove those distractions? I know social media, TV, they can be quite addictive for people.
It can be. You know, sometimes when you go on a retreat, like a meditation retreat, sometimes they're silent. But virtually always they'll say, you know, don't bring a phone or turn your phone off. I would say taking a holiday from phones, from social media, is a great way to get back into the present. However, it may not be easy if you're actually addicted. And you'll know, because if it's painful at first, then you're addicted.
Circling back to more specific book content here, Daniel.
Yes.
One of the interesting approaches that you and your co-author, Carrie Chernis, took was to look at both the internal subjective workings of the optimal state, as well as the perspective on how it looks from the outside. And I'm quoting you here, how we operate in this state. And you say that the optimal state maps to a surprising degree the benefits of emotional intelligence. Can you tell us about that?
So the optimal state is one in which you're in the present, you're highly focused, you're feeling positive, and you're feeling connected. And you could do a crosswalk with emotional intelligence, and that self-awareness and self-management, it's right there. Empathy, tuning into other people, being well-connected, it's right there also. So I'd say the optimal state describes emotional intelligence in other terms. And in fact, if you look at standard measures used, say, by companies to look at employees, one of them is engagement. Well, that's one of the hallmarks of the optimal state. Another is satisfaction. And that's still another hallmark of the optimal state. Feeling good while you're doing what you're doing, again, and being less likely to quit. They call it turnover in the business world, but it means I quit. All of those are aspects of the optimal state looked at through other lenses.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about EI, or emotional intelligence, versus IQ.
Sure.
There's a really interesting study you mentioned in the book where there's this group of college students from the Midwestern US. They took an emotional intelligence test prior to graduation and then completed a survey 10 to 12 years later. How did emotional intelligence predict their success, and why is that?
Well, emotional intelligence predicts your success in a career, but not your success in school. This is very interesting to me. In school, it's all about cognitive ability, IQ. When you think about it, you know, you're graded on how well you did on that test, which means how well you could regurgitate something you were taught or make an inference from what you know. And that matters enormously through college and into graduate school. But this, here's the paradox. Let's say you're at Google. Google notoriously only hires people at top 99% of IQ. So once you're at Google, I've talked to Google, I've visited Google, you're among a group of people who are really smart. In fact, they're as smart as you are. And it turns out that what makes you outstanding there has nothing to do with IQ, because everybody's smart. It's how you handle yourself and how you handle your relationships. Are you an outstanding team member? Are you emerging as a leader? That has to do with emotional intelligence. And the data shows, for example, in that study of the students in the Midwest, that emotional intelligence matters far more over the course of your career, not your school career, but your actual career. Take entrepreneurs. It turned out in a study of 65,000 entrepreneurs that IQ was not as powerful as emotional intelligence in predicting who would succeed. Emotional intelligence was twice as important in an entrepreneur's success. Because why? Well, you know, it's uncertain. You don't know how you're going to do. You have to handle your own emotions. You have to sense what's going on with other people. You have to handle relationships. It's very much an emotional intelligence game. So I would say that generally, once you're out of school and you're training, whatever role you get into, now what's going to distinguish you is your emotional intelligence.
And there are four key elements or key ingredients to emotional intelligence that you outline, and you show how those lead to an optimal state or help inform an optimal state. Can we talk a little, just giving our audience a brief overview of those four key pillars?
Sure. The four elements of emotional intelligence, and there are a lot of theories of emotional intelligence now, but most everyone agrees on this. It's self-awareness of emotions, knowing what you're feeling, why you're feeling it, how it shapes your perceptions and your thoughts and your impulse to act. Then managing your emotions, keeping the turbulent ones from distracting you too much, managing those, marshaling positive emotions, positive feelings, as I said before, keeping your eye on what really matters to you despite the distractions of the day. And here, it's important to say that one of the fundamental definitions of maturity is widening the gap between emotional impulse and action. And it's this second domain that helps you manage your emotional world well. Then there's tuning into other people's emotions, empathy, social awareness. There are three kinds of empathy. Cognitive, I know how you think about things. I know your perspective. I know the language you use to explain the world to yourself. This means I can communicate well with you because I know what terms you'll understand. The second, however, draws in a different part of the brain. It's emotional empathy, sensing what the other person feels, very different from cognitive. And this means I not only know how you think, but I know what you're feeling right now, and I can attune to that. And then there's a third kind, which I think may be the most important. It's little understood. It's called empathic concern, technically. It means I not only know how you think and feel, I care about you. This is what you want in your loved ones. This is what you want in your parents, or as a parent, you want this. This is what you want in your boss, by the way. I've gone around the world asking people to describe a boss they loved and a boss they hated with one term. And the boss they hated lacks emotional intelligence, and the boss they love is trustworthy, caring, supportive, guides them. The fourth part of emotional intelligence is relationship management. And in the workplace, we looked at people who are outstanding performers and what abilities they had in this domain. In the Daniel Goleman Emotional Intelligence online program, you can learn more about that. But it's things like, are you able to inspire? Can you say what has meaning here from the heart to the heart in a way that will move people? It's very motivating, creates a very positive climate in any organization. Can you guide people? Can you influence them? Can you coach them? This is often ignored by leaders, but it's important to think about it as developing strengths for the future for your organization, whatever that may be. So those are some of the elements of relationship management. So those are the four domains and some of the competencies within those domains that mark someone as outstanding.
Right, right. Now, based on what you said, there's a question I wanted to ask about how our boss predicts our life satisfaction. There's the third section of the book is emotional intelligence at work. And there there's a quote that I liked. He said, there's a powerful reason emotional intelligence in a leader matters for how well their workers perform. An employee's relationship with his or her boss is the best predictor of job satisfaction, which in turn is a strong predictor of overall life satisfaction. Can we talk more about that?
Yeah, this gets back to the bosses we love and the bosses we hate. And I don't know even where to begin. There's so much to say. But one of the most powerful factors in how we feel about our job is who we report to, who's our boss, and how, as I said before, a boss can be a source of terrible stress because leadership is the art of getting work done well through other people. And if you're one of those people and your boss is driving you so your boss will look good, I want those results. And he doesn't care if he like grinds you into the, you know, powder. That's one way of being a boss. There's another way, which is saying, you know, I really respect you. I want to support you. I'm here if you need me. Here's what we're doing. Here's why it matters. Here's what has meaning for me and I think for you. You know, inspiring people actually activates a very different network in the brain where you want to give your best. And that's a very different way to get those results. I know about companies that are have emotionally intelligent cultures, and in their performance reviews, they look not just at what results did you get, but how did you get those results? Because if you get them in the worst way, you're basically eroding the strength of the company or the organization. If you get them in the best way, you're strengthening it. And I think it matters very much. I wish there were this was talked about more.
I have a kind of a curveball question for you, Daniel. Just it came up in my mind a few times. It's a two-parter. So the first part is, Where does morality and ethics fit into the business mix when it comes to emotional intelligence and the ability to inspire people towards a goal? For instance, have you ever seen cases where a leader in a company is very emotionally intelligent, but uses that in a way to manipulate people towards goals that may not be healthy?
Right. Well, let's speak to that first. Sure. It's your second part.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
This is why I really emphasize caring and concern, empathic concern, because that is a value. That's a very positive value. And I think that it's not only concern for people within the organization, but for the impact of the organization. You know, you mentioned that I wrote a book about the ecological crisis. And basically, my argument is that business as usual, the way we've always done things, is, as we see now, destroying the Earth, not just carbon, but the eight systems that support life on the planet. They're all being eroded. And they're being eroded because at least capitalism, and I think capitalism is the world's dominant economic theory, praises growth and profit without regard for consequence. And I'd like to see consequence become part of the equation. It's being voiced, but I don't know that it's being actualized. In other words, companies will say we care, but then they end up doing things the same old way. I have a feeling that younger people today who are going to live through a kind of hellish future, it seems, will more and more care about whether a company actually is walking the talk. And for example, the methodology now exists to get an objective appraisal of the systemic impacts of a particular product or service. And there's even a metric for it. And the question is, are you doing anything to move it in the positive direction? The negative direction. I think this will become a competitive landscape in the future for companies. Then they need to show objectively that they're making things better, not worse. And it might be doing something different in your supply chain. If you're Unilever, maybe you're not going to get your palm oil from from a commodity distributor where you don't even know where it came from, and you're only getting it sourced from plantations that are not eroding a forest, for example. It's just one example, but every company can do better. And by the way, I think that blaming the victim is not the answer. I see recycling is good, but recycling is a pitiful response to the planetary crisis. It's something we can feel good about it, but it has a very minimal impact compared to operations at scale, which means big companies.
Well said, well said. Before I get to the second part of this question, I just want to remind our live audience, we're going to get to some of your questions for Daniel Goleman in a couple of minutes. So please go ahead and type those into the chat box on YouTube. Okay, the second part of that question, and I feel I've never asked anybody this question before. I feel like you might be the perfect person to ask because of your time studying in India and in a more traditional meditation practice, as well as taking these attention strengthening focus practices into a business setting. Is there a danger? Again, it's around the moral, ethical framework or spiritual framework from which a lot of these practices may have originated, of using our attention, our ability to focus, again, towards achievement to negative ends. And it might be the same answer, but it's just in the context of these more meditative practices.
You know, I think it's interesting that in the traditional Asian setting, every meditation practice I'm familiar with starts with an ethical framework. In mindfulness practice, it's called sila, virtue. The prescriptions came from, you know, the 5th century for monks. But it was left behind when we brought mindfulness to corporations or to schools. Because it doesn't fit with our cultural values. I think it's a big mistake because, yes, I agree. You could be a hyper-focused sociopath and not care. This is why I keep emphasizing empathic concern, because narcissists, sociopaths, Machiavellians don't care about other people. They don't care about the consequence. And I feel caring is a value very compatible with our culture, which can be paired with any of these disciplines.
That's great. Thank you, Daniel. We've got some really nice questions coming in here from our live audience, if it's okay with you to tend to some of those.
Happy to, of course.
Okay, great. There's a question here from Norm who says, how does nature deficit disorder play into a lack of optimal state?
So nature deficit disorder, as I understand it, means you spend too little time in nature and you don't really care about it. I've never thought about how it might relate to an optimal state. But in light of my last answer to you, maybe a sociopath would have one optimal state that doesn't care about nature, and maybe someone else would have an optimal state that did care.
That sounds like a pretty good answer. There's a question from the name on YouTube is TKM, who says, if your present experience is one of grief or sadness, right, is an optimal state being as present as you can with those emotions, even though they may not feel quote unquote positive?
TKM, that is very well said. Every emotion is important. They're all messages to us, and grief or sadness is telling us to slow down, reflect, think deeply, feel deeply. I don't think it's a mistake. And I think it's part of that recovery cycle that I mentioned before. And people who are going through grief about, say, the death of someone they love, often will dose themselves where they'll have a period of grief where they have to come to grips with a loss or face the loss and their feelings about the loss. But then they'll come out of it for a while. And maybe that optimal state, I haven't thought about it, but maybe the optimal state has a pass for moments of grief. Or maybe grief is that optimal state in that situation.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, and in my own practice with emotions and awareness, the idea that, you know, when you're resisting or fighting against the emotion, you create more suffering on top of the suffering you're already experiencing.
Could be. I don't know.
Okay.
Can I say I don't know?
Yes, of course. That's refreshing.
I don't know everything, that's for sure.
I second that. There's a question here from NLP channel, who says, how does this affect the teen brain that is in the process of restructuring this optimal, this approach to the optimal
state? Did you say the teen, T-E-E-N?
Teen brain, yeah.
Yeah, so as you watch a child grow, you're actually seeing the external signs in their behavior of growth in the brain. So for example, from between the ages of 5 to 7, roughly, something called cognitive control manifests. It's where the prefrontal cortex grows and is able to manage the emotional impulse better. You know, the difference between a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old is graphic that way. And it's because of this growth. And it continues into the teen years. Often in the teen years, I hear girls will develop more prefrontal control earlier than boys. So boys tend to be more impulsive, take greater risks. I think there are kind of biologically driven differences, particularly during childhood and teen years, between people at one age and another. I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, I think it does. And there's a sort of a secondary part to the question from the audience mm-hmm. member that says, it's about social media, phones, and connecting for teens.
Yeah.
So just any comments you have on that?
Well, you know, as children grow, their primary relationships are no longer family, but friends. And social media and phones are a key way for teens to stay in touch with each other, which is important for their growth. But as I said before, if they do that at the expense of actually hanging out, I don't think it's so great.
Right. Okay, this is there's kind of two questions in this realm from two different audience members. So I'll mm-hmm. start with the first one and we'll see how it maybe leads to the next. From Farah, who says, considering the fact that EI, emotional intelligence, is so important and essential, and it is a teachable ability, why do schools not teach it to students?
Actually, I think Vancouver, where Banyan Books is one of the places where there's a lot of what's called social-emotional learning. But these programs are extra. They're added to the curriculum. And it's the decision to do this is made district by district, kind of ground up, at least in North America. I think in Canada, there are a lot of countries, for example, in Europe and around the world, where all schools have to follow a standard curriculum, which is dictated from above, so to speak. The government gives it to a school. And so the decision to bring in something like social-emotional learning, which is emotional intelligence in an age-appropriate way, covering the whole spectrum, and from, you know, age 5 to going to university, those are the best programs. The best programs actually also involve teachers who have to exemplify it in families, by the way. But if you're interested in these programs, there's a clearinghouse called the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, CASEL.org is the website. It describes the best practices. Why is this not disseminated everywhere? I don't know, but I think it should be.
CASEO.org.
No, CASEL.
EL, sorry.
Emotional learning.
Got it.
Yep.
CASEL.org. Okay. Yep. So the second question, I think you partially answered it there, is are you satisfied with the teachings of emotional intelligence in schools today? And if not, what's missing?
Well, it's quite, I would say that what's missing varies from place to place. There's some wonderful schools where nothing is missing, but there are studies that show very clearly that the implementation is key. How well you bring it to a school. Do teachers go through a program that helps them with their own handling of emotions? Because they're modeling it constantly to their students. That's one of the best practices. Are families brought in so they understand what's going on? And can be part of it. That's also a best practice. And, you know, if a teacher doesn't really care, like, oh, this is something else I have to do, I don't really want to spare the time, it's not going to be effective, I don't think. So I would say that how a school implements is key, and that it varies widely from teacher to teacher and school to school.
There's another question from TKM that I think is really interesting. What would your suggestions be in the EI model for people who are very highly empathetic and caring, but struggle with managing emotions because of this sensitivity?
I was going to say that, you know, if you're like a classic empath and you read people's feelings and then they overwhelm you, the problem isn't reading feelings. The problem is the overwhelm, that you can't manage it. And that means that you've got to strengthen what we now call emotional balance, the ability to handle upsetting emotions. And that will make you a more effective person. Keep the empathy, up the self-management.
What are some effective ways? You mentioned earlier one of the signs of emotional maturity is that gap between, I forget exactly how you worded, the emotional reaction we feel within and the impulse to actually express it. That seems related to what we're talking about here. How do we actually practice that, strengthen that?
Anything you do that delays instant gratification strengthens it. So when your kid comes home from school and you say, finish your homework before you play with your Xbox, you're helping that child strengthen the capacity to widen the gap. As adults, every time we say, you know, I'm not going to have that chocolate cake for dessert, you're strengthening the ability. It's will. And the person who first pointed this out was Viktor Frankl, who in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, talks about how he managed to survive 4 years in Nazi concentration camps. He said, I had no control over the externals, but they didn't control my mind. That was my domain. And it's true for all of us. No matter what the externals, we still are masters of our own inner world, or can be.
VC has a question that says, in terms of grief, would it be better to let the emotion out completely for a long period of time or to distract yourself by doing something else to uplift your mood?
As I said before, I'm not an expert on grief. I suspect it's not always useful to distract yourself, that you need to let yourself cathart sometimes. But I think it's an individual matter, and I don't actually know. I don't know you, for example.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And is that kind of pointing to the fact that we all process emotions in different ways based on our nervous system?
Well, it's not just our nervous system. It's our upbringing. It's our capacities that we develop as life goes on. And each of us differs. For example, there's something called the Emotional and Social Competence Inventory. It's what's called a 360, where other people evaluate you on these four domains and the 12 competencies within them. If anyone's interested, you can get it from a company called Korn Ferry. And the interesting thing about that is everyone has a profile of strengths and limits across the domains, and it varies from person to person. This is used to help people get better at emotional intelligence, but the way in which you get better depends on where you start. It's like, you know, biology. What are your lipids? What's your good cholesterol? What's your bad cholesterol? You know, you get a readout when you get a physical of all of these elements of your physical health, and the doctor's only interested in what can be improved. And that's the question for everyone. What can you improve in the emotional intelligence domain?
Okay. There's kind of a follow-up question here on emotional balance from Therese, who says, help me understand what practice would address emotional balance. Is that also about recovery time?
The meditation practice actually is one of the ways you can get more emotionally balanced. I think there are two or three main avenues here. One is increasing your internal capacity for what's called cognitive control, Cognitive control is the element of the brain that lets you widen the gap between impulse and action. And strengthening attention is a way to strengthen cognitive control. A second is to monitor your self-talk and see if you can change it from highly critical to more positive. So those are two very powerful paths, I think.
I think we have time for one more audience question. A big thanks to everyone in our live audience for all your great questions. This one is from Sabina, who says, Forbes article suggested that women make better leaders and entrepreneurs. How do gender differences about EI explain this finding? How does transgender behavior fit into that explanation?
Okay, let's put transgender aside because I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
And talk about gender differences.
Okay.
When you talk about behavioral differences between men and women, you're talking about complex behaviors. And if you were to map a reading of this, you're talking about two largely overlapping bell curves. For example, on most tests of emotional intelligence, women on average do better than men on average. So that may be one basis of women maybe becoming better leaders, particularly if we can neutralize the biases in the culture against women leaders and against women, which I'm quite against. I think we're losing talent because of that and depressing people because of that. But put that aside, women tend to do better, for example, on empathy scales. We talk to girls about relationships. We talk to boys about things. And that may be, at least in Western culture, that may, the socialization may have an influence there. Men turn out to be better than women on average at managing upsetting emotions. So, but that doesn't mean that the most empathic man couldn't be as empathic as the most empathic woman, or the woman who has the best control over her upsetting emotions couldn't be as good as the best man. So when you look at an individual, as I said before, you really need to look at the total profile. And I think the averages are different, but as I said, they're largely overlapping bell curve, and they don't predict how any one person would do, whether a man or a woman.
More generalization from that kind of a study.
Yes, and it doesn't predict how a particular person will do in a particular position.
Right, okay. We're getting close to our time here, Daniel, and it's been so wonderful to have you. I'm really grateful, and I know the Banyan community was really excited about you coming today. Just a reminder, we've been speaking with Daniel Goleman about his new book, Optimal, How to Sustain Personal and Organizational Excellence Every Day. Daniel, before we go, I'm just wondering, the last part of the book, the last section is on the future of emotional intelligence. I'm curious to hear a little bit about your vision for how emotional intelligence can help us address some of the really big issues we're facing on planet Earth.
Yeah, so emotional intelligence, as I see it, makes us effective in relationships and managing ourselves. It doesn't do the whole job. I think we need systems thinking. As I said, we need to understand the larger system that regulate life on the planet and how human action affects those systems and what to do about it. I think we're going to need a lot of creative solutions. We have to learn how to do things differently and better going into the future. So I would see emotional intelligence as paired with, of course, cognitive ability. That matters, but it's not the whole thing either, as well as a systems view and a creative outlook. I think that's the magic going into the future.
Wonderful. Any other closing thoughts? Any programs or work that you'd like people to know about?
Well, you mentioned, and I thank you, for the Daniel Goleman Emotional Intelligence Online Program. It's something I value. There's a team emotional intelligence program, Team EI, that I think is very good if you're part of a team or lead a team. It can upgrade the effectiveness. And as I said, there's the emotional and social competence inventory if you really want to develop these skills more deeply. Wonderful. I want to thank you, Ross. I think you're a great interviewer. Time just flew, and that's a good sign.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Much appreciated.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. The show is edited by Abdo Habani. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books, or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.